I'm delighted to introduce the moderator for the second panel on the Turkish economy, Dr. Kemal Kirişçi. He is the TÜSİAD Senior Fellow and Director of the Turkey Project in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. At Brookings and previously on the faculty of Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, he has produced a rich body of scholarly research on topics including EU-Turkish relations, US-Turkish relations, Turkish foreign policy and trade policies. He is the author of several books, the newest entitled Turkey and the West, Fault Lines in a Troubled Alliance, just came out in July, and it's you can purchase it here if you'd like. We are very grateful to Kemal for taking the reins in the session, and I'll leave it to him to introduce the panel and lead the conversation from now through 12:30. Kemal, please welcome him and the panel, and Kemal, thank you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I'm not sure whether I'll be able to rein the panel, as Liesl Hintz has done. I'm not sure I'll be able to speak as fast as she has been able to do, so please bear with me. There's a lot that will need to be covered here. And although in the program we have our Honorable Arne Leitz as the first speaker, member of the European Parliament, I have sought his permission to allow me to start with Shebnem Kalemli. She's a professor at the University of Maryland, and right now she has a fellowship working also with the Fed as well as IMF. And I thought we could start with a bigger picture, and then finally, somewhere along the line, we will get to Ömer Taşpınar, my good friend and professor at National Defense University. Shebnem, there is a puzzlement, and the puzzlement is that almost every month we read in the papers how the Turkish growth rate is creeping up, it keeps going up, and the Turkish government frequently uses it as a sign that against all odds, Turkey is doing very well. But simultaneously, we also read the way in which the inflation rate keeps creeping up, which my limited knowledge of economy suggests that there is the kind of relationship we would expect there to be. But yet then, the third leg of economy is employment. Employment rates are not going up. If anything, unemployment is increasing. So how can we really square this circle, as the expression goes, and help us to understand what are the dynamics that are prevailing in the Turkish economy right now?
Okay, thank you very much. Let me first start by thanking Gönül and the Middle East Institute for inviting me to this panel. It's a pleasure to be here. Gönül told me to give short answers. So very short answer to your question. You said, how can we reconcile? Short answer, we cannot. One of those numbers is fake. So that's the short answer. So let me explain. So it is true that when we have very fast-paced growth, output growth, GDP growth, that is generally accompanied by inflation, high inflation rates. But it also has to be accompanied by decreasing unemployment rates or increasing employment rates and a central bank policy, if the central bank is independent, that is raising the interest rates. That is just standard economics 101. You can see the application of this in the United States, in Europe, in China, India, emerging markets, advanced countries, it doesn't matter. If you are, you know, you have a very fast-growing economy, out of control, overheating, that you will see high output growth and high inflation growth. Also, you know, declining unemployment rates, going to natural rates, something around 4 or 5%. Then, you know, as a central bank, you raise the interest rates, slow that down, and to rein the inflation. So this is clearly not the case. So Turkey's economy, in reality, slowed down considerably since 2007. Let me correct something here. In the previous panel, there were a couple numbers that were wrong. It wasn't the case that all this stuff is after 2012, 2013, blah, blah. That's not correct. Turkey's economy grew very, very fast on sound grounds from 2002 to 2007. Okay, that was real growth, real productivity growth, backed by structural reforms, institutional reform, macroeconomic stability, financial stability. Started after the 2001 financial crisis as part of the IMF World Bank structural reform program. That, you know, brought and combined with a very important anchor, EU membership anchor that we will talk in detail today. That came until 2007. You can bring it until 2010 if you want, but that 2007-2010 period is special because that was the global financial crisis period. And the latest part of that period, 2009-2010 part, was particularly the European crisis, which of course hit also Turkey harder. So, you know, you can say 2007 or 2010, but that's it. After 2010, Turkey did not have real structural reform, real institutional reform, and real output growth. In the sense we want that you have unemployment going down, economy is growing, GDP per capita is growing, inequality is going down, and so forth. That did not happen in the last 8 years. So, coming back to the puzzle, what is this amazing, and we saw that, right? I mean, pretty much since 2010, 11, 12, I mean, this started in 2007, but let's say the first part is the global financial crisis part. We started seeing, you know, growth rates as low as like 2, which doesn't go with a country like Turkey. Look at how much India is growing. Look at how much China is growing. If you're an emerging market economy with that big a population, and if you're on a transitional growth path, you have to grow 6, 7, 8% a year. Okay? We didn't see these growth rates. We were seeing something like 2.5, 2.9, and suddenly we start seeing like 5 point something. What happened? So TÜİK, this is the statistical institute in Turkey that calculates the GDP numbers. Counterpart here is going to the Bureau of Economic Analysis or Bureau of Labor Statistics in the United States. They changed their methodology. They changed their methodology, meaning now instead of applying the OECD methodology, World Bank methodology, IMF methodology, the methodology that is standard across emerging markets and advanced countries, they decided to do two new things. I mean, there are a lot of details here. I'm not going to get into details, but just in a nutshell, two things. One, they changed the weights that they account investment growth, meaning you can give more weight to construction sector and less weight to other sectors. That will definitely give you a pump up because we know construction sector grows in Turkey. Two, more importantly than that, because this is only give you only you know part for coming from the investment, not overall output. So the second change they did is important. They changed the source of the data. The data that underlies GDP numbers come from production surveys. You want to measure how much produced in the economy, how much consumed in the economy. This is a loop, right? And the loop that when it doesn't close down, it comes from the outside. You also consume goods coming from outside, and you sell goods to outside, meaning other countries. So this goes down to production survey, how much produced, how much valued, and all that. They changed that. Now their data comes from finance ministry and tax returns, okay? So this is a fundamental change. There were other countries that did this. This led to a change to GDP up to 20-40%. Two examples, Greece and China. And once we realized that, well, with Greece, it was too late. They were in the middle of a crisis because it turns out that all their GDP numbers were fake. And the China, that, you know, serious slowdown in China was actually turned out to be a slowdown after the revision. Okay.
Wow. Absorbing that will take a while for us, Shibnem. Let me turn to you, Arne. Shibnem's dear father was the person who saw through the original customs union in the parliament as the speaker of the parliament. I recall those days very well. There were those who thought that we were just going to be markets and that the EU was going to be a partner and benefit from the Turkish market. But when we look at academic literature today, as well as business people, there is a recognition that the customs union did give an important helping hand to make Turkey the kind of attractive, dynamic economy it was around the time that Shibnem has made references to. My question is a bit of a political economy question, but to do again with squaring the circle there. When I look at these figures to do with the customs union, it is really Turkish exports are growing significantly to the European Union. While Turkish exports, the other day I made a very quick calculation, back of a notebook, Turkish exports to the United States in the first 9 months of this month amounts to twice Turkey's exports to Russia and Iran. Structurally, what this tells me is that in terms of exports, which is critical to this economy, Turkey has nowhere else to go but the European Union. Yet, the government's narrative and the government's policies don't add up. How do we square this circle here, and what does the picture look like from where you are, the European Parliament? Are you going to give the government a helping hand to upgrade this customs union?
Thank you very much, first of all, for having me here to the Middle East Institute and the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, and so being proud sitting next to someone who has family background. I assume you talk about the customs union agreement which came into place on 31st of December 1995, which is actually the first agreement on that state that the European Union did as well towards third country situation, but also having this special situation of Turkey, who was and is in the process, so to say, of applying to become a member of the European Union, which at that time I think also nurtured a lot of positive results for the business and also for the understanding why to move forward. And actually, as we have heard today, that has been taken up by Erdogan himself, because business was running quite well throughout the last years. So where do we stand? The European Union has different sides. We talk on member states. They have their interests. We talk on the European Commission. And we talk on the European Parliament to make it a bit more complex, but very important. We have talked and discussed that issue as there are many cornerstones which are very difficult in our relationships as such. Let me tell you that I've been in Turkey myself, being at the week where the immunity was taken off by the parliamentarians, and doing a press conference of a colleague of mine from the Netherlands, from the Liberals, calling that country moves and sliding in towards a dictatorship. From my perspective, coming from East Germany, seeing the science of Turkey, which has had happened then already through the scientific people we have met from the scientific community, which were dropped out of their jobs, but also the media have been covered, actually taken out of place. So in that regard, the political background is actually a very difficult situation now for us in the European Union, also in the European Parliament. At that time, the question was not on the customs union's question, but, for example, on visa liberalization. And we made clear that they have not fulfilled the requirements. There's no visa liberalization going to be. And now as Turkey moved and slipped towards the direction where we are now, we have actually and facing a very critical situation where I think, in terms of other relationships the European Union has towards other countries, the business components is a crucial component. That is the biggest word we are having in terms of playing a role in the situation of the development of Turkey itself. As you mentioned, Turkey is relying very much on the European Union. And by numbers, we look at the Turkish export to the EU, it's almost up to 45%, but also the imports are the biggest on 38%. So they actually see how big, for both sides, Turkey is a very important situation, and where there is in the customs unions a lot of juice in terms of where do we act on that. And the European Parliament made clear that, and I can read you some of the passages we have agreed on in the European Parliament in July this year, I quote, believes that strengthening the trade relations could bring concrete benefits to the citizens in Turkey and the EU, and therefore, in the light of the current failings of the customs unions, supports the Commission's proposal to start negotiations on the upgrading of the customs union, reiterates that the EU is Turkey's main trading partner and that two-thirds of foreign direct investments in Turkey comes from the EU member states, underlines furthermore the economic importance of Turkey as a growth market for the EU, considers involvement of social partners in negotiations as crucial, calls on the Commission to include a clause of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the upgraded customs union between the Turkey and the EU, making human rights and fundamental freedom a key coordination utility, recalls the customs unions can only achieve its full potential when Turkey fully implements its additional protocol to vis-à-vis all member states, notes the Commission conclusion that further trade integration with the EU would be stimulating by Turkey's eliminating the imprecedence of the functioning of the customs unions. And there we go. It is important where and how the human rights clause is and fundamental freedoms clause are falling into the situation, as has been pointed out by Michael in the beginning of our session, that we are in a very difficult state. There are German members of the media being imprisoned in Turkey. And I've been there and calling for the relief in the summer when we had the trials on Cumhuriyet in July. But also our members and Michel Müntefering, who is here this morning, is not and was not allowed as a normal situation to visit our soldiers in their NATO state, Turkey. So the political framework is so difficult that I'm going to look forward to our discussion how that could be embedded and has to be embedded to work on the customs union. So we are in a very difficult stake, and I think making the square as a circle, it might stay as a square, but we have to maybe circle some other areas. So we will discuss on that.
Thank you. We'll certainly come back and maybe also a little bit discuss some of those imperfections that the parliamentary paragraph you quoted us makes references to. Ömer, in the previous panel, towards the end, Aykan Erdemir was pointing out how the alliance between the Gülenists and the Erdoğan AKP hallowed Turkey's institutions. And one of those institutions that appear to be hallowing day by day is private property and also guarantees for the investments that business people are making. The Turkish economy structurally, we are well aware, depends highly on foreign direct investment. The Turkish society is not able to come up with the savings that is necessary to drive the growth that Turkey needs. Şebnem made references to it. So what's happening there? How could you elaborate on the way in which those two institutions are being weakened in Turkey, private property as well as the guarantees of investments. Actually, only yesterday the president made a point that there are some traitors in Turkey, business traitors that are scrambling their funds out of the country. But this morning then he tried to correct it, saying that business Turkey remains open to business in terms of foreign investments. Could you open this up and help us to better understand what is going on out there?
Thank you, Kemal, for that easy question. And I'll try to...
Yes. Blame it on your wife, you know.
I guess one way to approach this question is to point out at how the political situation cannot be disentangled from the economic situation. Mm-hmm. When you have an absence of rule of law, which seems to be increasingly the case in Turkey right now, an emergency law, a draconian emergency law, combined with a political culture where you really don't have an independent business community. And this is a deeply rooted problem in Turkey. Normally, for a capitalist liberal market economy to function, you need to have secure private property rights. That's what we know from theory. If you don't have secure private property rights, if there is arbitrary governmental intervention, then you have a basic deficiency, a structural deficiency for the healthy functioning of capitalism. And we can talk for hours about how the AKP increasingly is becoming hegemonic and arbitrary and imposing basically its own sets of laws. But there is a deeper problem in Turkey that I think secure property rights have always been problematic for our country. From the get-go, Turkish industrialization, the emergence of a Turkish business community, a Turkish bourgeoisie, so to speak, required the appropriation of the wealth and real estate of non-Muslim minorities in Turkey. Turkey had a business community, had some level of capitalism in the 19th century, but it was primarily the non-Muslim communities, Armenians, Jews, and Greeks. And Turkish nation building, as we know, tragically, is partly a product of the de-Hellenization of Turkey. There are no more Greek communities left. It's partly a product of, however we call it, Armenian massacres, genocide. Basically, there are no more Armenians. And the Jewish community has shrank. And we know from the 1940s that private property rights, from the wealth tax, from appropriation, have always been problematic. Whenever there was a conflict with Cyprus, the Greek community of Istanbul would be on the receiving end of this kind of arbitrary policies. So the government has a tendency to interfere, and the whole industrialization of Turkey, the creation of a Turkish business community, was a primarily state-led affair, where capitalism, markets, private sector did not have clear-cut autonomy or independence. Import substitution industrialization was the way Turkey wanted to establish a development model in the 1960s, 70s, and we know that this led to, unlike in the Asian miracle, Asian tiger scenario, a situation where patronage, cronyism, and major loss-making public sector enterprises emerged. So there was a level of endemic corruption, systemic clientelism, always built into Turkish political system. And it took really short periods of maybe some growth with higher productivity. I think Şebnem mentioned 2002 to 2007. One can think maybe the early era of Özal reforms, when there was privatization, where there was some productivity gains. But overall, the systemic failure of Turkey in terms of having what Daran Acemoğlu calls inclusive institutions, mm-hmm. transparency, accountability, the quality of Turkish mm-hmm. institutions have always been lacking. Mm-hmm. And as we can blame the AKP today for appropriating the wealth of the Gulen community, for instance. People say about $10 to $15 billion worth of companies have been appropriated. But that's not a new story. The Turkish state has been doing that against enemies that it mm-hmm. considers for a long time. So this is not a question of political culture. This is a question of, in my opinion, the independence of a business community, the independence of TÜSİAD, the independence of basically all these companies that, to a certain degree, owe their wealth, their existence, their profitability to public procurement, to contracts with the government, to business with the government. We can explain many things in Turkey, including the independence of free media, based on the fact that the largest media company of Turkey, Doğan, Aydın Doğan, he's also very active in the energy sector. Well, if you want to get government contracts, good luck being an independent newspaper in Turkey. So there is this cronyism, there is this clientelistic patronage networks that has, in my opinion, really poisoned the quality of Turkish economy, liberal market reforms, and the Turkish quality of Turkish democracy for a long time.
Thanks, Ömer. It's there that I'd like to come back to you, Şebnem, against the picture that Ömer has just drawn. And against the challenges around the growth rate in Turkey that you just shared with us, the technical aspects, how do you see the Turkish economy moving forward? How is the Turkish economy going to keep up with this globalization, but also, much more importantly, and there allow me to make the link between Ömer's point about how critical guarantees for private property is if an economy is going to be innovative, if an economy is going to be able to move forward. I'm not an economist, but I keep reading these pieces about how we're moving towards digitalized economies and how, in that sense, advance the ability for an economy to produce high technology products and be able to export them. How will Turkey be able to deal with these issues, and to link it to the previous panel? How do you see this impacting on the upcoming elections in 2019? What will you be able to do?
Too many questions, but short answer. With the current ingredients, Turkish economy cannot deal. No, it's not possible. So, I mean, that something has to give, right? Things have to change. Let me add to Mr. Ömer's assessment, and then it helps me to tie back and answer your question. So when, he said, first of all, I agree with everything he said. I mean, it's absolutely important, secure property rights and institutional, not having institutional decay. That theory he mentioned, right, the most important thing for, investment, foreign investment especially, is the protection of property rights. This is actually not only a theoretical result. This is a, empirical result, which is shown by my research in our 2008 publication titled Why Capital Doesn't Flow from Rich to Poor Countries, joint work with Laura Alfaro of Harvard Business School. We showed, using data, over 100 countries and 60 years, that the most important determinant of foreign direct investment into a country at a given point, at a given in time, or any type of country, is the secure property rights, protection of the property rights. Why on earth a foreigner should come to your country if he thinks his stuff is going to be stolen? This is not going to happen. So this is the most important thing for foreign direct investment. Now, why foreign direct investment is important? Exactly because what Professor Kemal Kürsü just said. Turkey is a fast-growing emerging market. These countries need to import intermediate inputs to be able to sustain that growth. This is true for all these type of emerging countries, not specific to Turkey. Why? Because these countries are not technology leaders. Technology leaders are United States and, certain countries in Europe, not all the countries in Europe, like Germany, for example. You have to import technology and skills from these countries. You can also do your own research and development, for sure. I'm not saying that cannot be done. But that has to be kept supported and feeding from this imported technology that you are going to bring in your country. And that's what we call foreign direct investment. So don't think foreign direct investment only like, Toyota comes and builds a factory in your country. Yes, that counts foreign direct investment too, but a lot of skill and technology comes with that. We always focus on these export numbers because that's what, Turkish government wants us to focus. Exports increase this much, exports increase this much. A very, very wide misconception. That number doesn't mean anything if you don't look at imports. Mm-hmm. Exactly what Mr. Lee said. Exports minus imports what matters, which is known as the external deficit or current account deficit. Now, some of it is, good, because if you have a deficit, that means your imports are more than exports. That can be a good thing if those imports are bringing technology, raw materials, skills into your country that you will channel to productive investment and upgrading your technology. That's a good thing. But if all those imports are going to consumption goods, So, building unproductive investment, then that's not good. So it's not only that we have to look at both exports and imports, we have to also look at content of imports, okay, what is coming into the country. Now, FDI is actually a very, very important part of that import because the other side of exports minus import is the financial side. And the big item on the financial side that is good for the country, that is going to help the growth of the country, is going to be FDI type of investment, foreign direct investment, not this debt that the banks are getting or not the money coming to stock market. Turkey doesn't have a big stock market. Turkey doesn't have that deep financial markets, right? But FDI coming into the country, foreign direct investment, is going to be absolutely important. And that ties back, so that's absolutely what we need to, going forward, keep this space in this globalized world and all that. And that ties back to this European Union angle. So in the whole past 60 years, right, of Turkish democracy, actually it goes even further, the period that FDI quadrupled and increased tremendously is those initial years of the becoming formal member, formal accession country to EU, 2004 to 2000. It was amazing increase in FDI. Why? Because that institutional, that lack of, strong institution that Mr. Ömer mentioned, because he said this was always a problem in Turkey, not just today, correct, that was suddenly under the EU umbrella, right? Because what is the expectation of the market? What is the expectation of the businessmen? Now they're saying, okay, this country is now going to adopt these laws, rules, regulations, secure property rights being one of them, because they have to harmonize everything to EU standards. And EU is a place we trust to invest, because there are laws, rules, regulations. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing anchor for Turkish economy, much stronger than credible monetary policy. That did a lot too, but, you know, becoming a formal accession member to European Union did a lot of good to Turkey, and we lost that right now. Mm-hmm.
Very good, Şebnem. But sometimes you have to realize that some of us do not have quick enough chips to process the information you're sharing with us. So
sure.
Please slow down
a bit.
And the next question I'll ask before we go to the audience in the next round is looking forward. You know, how long is this economy going to be capable of limping along? 6 months, 2 months, 5 months? I mean, when we look back at our history, right, we do have a long history of crises. Next round, though. One thing that has always fascinated me about the first customs union was the way in which the European Parliament came onto the scene and said, we will only ratify this if certain measures are introduced with respect to improving human rights in Turkey. I remember those days vividly, and I frankly am one of those who consider that day as a turning point. That's the point at which I think the European Union began to engage Turkey positively in the political sense of the word, but also economically. Now, my question here is the European Union still able to do that? Would the European Union be able to put the kind of carrot that it was capable of putting in front of not just Turkey, but Central and East European countries? Can we still expect the European Union to play that kind of role? If yes, why? If no, why? If you could share with us, and then depending on your response, we'll start to feel whether we can have some hope for the future or not.
Not putting enough pressure on me. Do I speak slow enough?
No, you're all right. I'm
coming actually from a region in Germany where you speak very slow, even if you speak at all. So it's kind of a Mainish situation.
The more Swiss German you can speak, the better it will be.
All right. So let me come back on that, because, as you said, it's a very crucial turning point the European Parliament has taken up. And on this history, even I would like to elaborate a little bit that you see where you stand, because we are here in the United States of America. We had a huge debate in the European Parliament on the trade agreement with the United States and with Canada. Canada was called CETA, TTIP was called for the US, and we have actually took a stand, and we have been actually proceeding. What is in trade negotiations has never been tabled so far in the mandate. So we were actually always guessing in the parliamentarians where we stand. And we have achieved a new stand that, as we have a new trade agreement with Austria and New Zealand, the mandate even had to be discussed and voted on in the European Parliament just recently. So on TTIP, our members in the Parliament were not even able, in particular also the National Parliament, to look at the papers and had to give up their cell phone and not documenting anything. So so actually the Parliament progressed in its rights, mm-hmm, and it's bringing up normality and standards. And to tell you a little story, I've just returned from the Philippines, where we call there the special trade arrangements to the Philippines becoming a new democracy, and actually, like Turkey, building up capacity. It's called GSP Plus, a special trade instrument, where the country is moving, speeding up, and having less taxes to pay. And this is linked to the human rights question as well. And I made clear as a member of the European Parliament that as this is now under evaluation, we are not looking towards actually to continue trading like that as a member of the European Parliament. That is going to be challenged by the beginning of next year, as this is an important factor to stop the special trading instrument, which actually became very positive development as we are now the best trading partner to the Philippines. So the Commission is very resilient on that, but we are straightforward that human rights matter to us. And therefore, so I was saying as a member that I'm staying for that. Duterte, this was because of the drug war he's putting up as a terror instrument toward the Philippines. He called in the European ambassadors the day after and very rudely saying, fuck off Europeans, leave the country in the next 24 hours. Because I put the point on the GSP Plus and the trading instruments of the European Union. The Foreign Office called me if I'm all right, and but I was just telling them what I said and actually what is in the contract. So we have to be very keen, particularly also towards Turkey. There are many situations I actually foreseen actually being pressure inside Turkey. For example, the situation, the state of emergency is being called by lots of business groups from Turkey to take it off because it's harming the situation as well. Also, if you look at the tax rises, the tax rate will rise because the government somehow has to get more money into the system. And so we might look at facing that in Turkey as well. From my perspective, besides that, the inflation on 11.9% is actually draining out Turkish business investments, investing outside Turkey in order to make their money on a safe haven somehow. So there's a lot of pressure inside the Turkish business community and the investments itself. But towards the European Union, I think we have to be very clear because the accession talks are also frozen. And I'm not sure how far we get in the customs unions. If there's no movement on the Turkish side, as we have learned, Erdogan towards the next election has to move up because he needs a good business situations and a good economy situation. So he has to move also in terms of the political situation in order to fulfill requirements. Visa requirement will not come up. The question is, where do we raise the bar on the human rights question? As we have heard this morning, quite explicitly, how many people are imprisoned, where the media stands, as this is one of the points we're calling as well. But also the human rights situation, even towards European citizens inside Turkey. So there needs to be a lot of improvement by the government, actually, to come close to fulfill requirements. Nevertheless, I definitely underline the private property rights you mentioned are crucial. Also, we don't have a trade dispute mechanism situation. We need to have that, and it's been called by the German and by the European businesses. We have, for example, trading goods of the European Union coming into Turkish markets who have very difficulties. For example, if you trade shoes and textile, you have to again and again have the certifications that this is on a safe situation. Also, if you look at the situation on medicine, and the whole field has to again testify that they are right, and they're actually Turkish opportunities to visit the companies if they fulfill the obligations to be good companies. And so there are situations which have to be taken up as well. And so the mountain of work is not getting smaller, and the government has to react.
The list inevitably is a long one, because just as there are grievances on the side of the European Union with respect to the functioning of the old customs union, there is a very long one on the Turkish side as well. However, I take your point that it is the more political ones and the human rights-related issues that are going to tie down the prospects of initiating the beginning of negotiations to upgrade the customs union. But just as I did with Shebnem, I wanted to give you a sneak preview of the next question coming. You made reference, as you read that quote from the European Parliament, I noticed references to the additional protocol. And the additional protocol, the term is usually a cover word for Cyprus and the need to resolve the issue of Cyprus. Next round, I'd like you to give a few, if you could share with us a few ideas about how you see the prospects of it, given the efforts that have been done to resolve the issue, ensure the reunification of the island, and that hasn't happened. In other words, the question I have, the next question is, if we do get the upgrading of the negotiations to upgrade the customs union going, Is there a risk that Cyprus may again tie down Turkey? Ömer, to come back to the rule of law, I mean, it's amazing the way in which that practically any issue that we've brought up in the context of the Turkish economy comes back down to the matter of rule of law. One thing that fascinated me, Ömer, over the last summer was, I think in July, the way in which suddenly a list of 700 German companies appeared as supporting terrorism. Okay. However, that list did not live more than a couple of hours lifespan. Very quickly, there was intervention from the side of the government and the withdrawal of the list from the public view. What can we make of this, Ömer? Is this a sign that there is a recognition of the importance of rule of law, the importance of protecting private property? What might have driven this, and what might have also motivated that sudden response? Is there any hope that we may see more of this becoming part of a policy and beginning to repair the damage that has been done to respecting private property and the rule of law?
Actually, the episode you mentioned is a very good example of understanding the dilemma of Erdogan. Erdogan's winning formula, the reason why he's able to still win elections in Turkey, is based on two strategies. The first one is to mobilize populist nationalism and to argue that the country is basically under attack. And this nationalist narrative was part of this list to basically portray foreign capital and foreigners who don't want this strong Turkey acting against Turkish interests. The second part of Erdogan's winning formula is to be able to provide services, social economic services, to the core public support that he has, mainly lower and middle income communities. For this, the economy needs to have a certain level of growth rate. There has to be a certain level of economic viability to his policies. And when you endanger with your nationalist populist narrative any hope of Turkey getting not foreign direct investment, but even short-term portfolio investment on the grounds that basically this is no longer a country where there is rule of law, you endanger your economic policies. If we really want to understand why Erdogan is winning, we really have to focus perhaps more than populist nationalism, which is a good thing to have when things go badly, into the real bread and butter issue, which is the economy. It's very hard for us, in my opinion, to understand the reason why the AKP has been able to win election after election without the ability of public spending and the ability to provide these services, especially the healthcare services and subsidized healthcare, but also subsidized housing. So there is a situation where the Turkish economy is dependent on this construction sector for employment. The Turkish economy is dependent on public spending and is able to do that thanks to the structural reforms that were implemented that reformed the banking system in 2001, but also the fact that Turkey from 2002 until relatively recently, until a few years ago, had some level of fiscal discipline and the inflation was under control. Compare this with the 1990s. During the 1990s, which people in Turkey are accustomed to, you had structural inflation to the tune of 60-70%. You had chronic political instability, chronic corruption, and a war with the Kurds, a military intervention that destabilized the system, crisis with Europe. What Erdogan managed to achieve with basically political stability and low inflation was a public spending portfolio where debt servicing, where basically the accumulated debt was increasingly paid, and he had more room for public spending. Part of that public spending was invested in mega projects, but a more important part of it was at the municipal level and used for subsidized food, coal, education. So you basically had a level of dependency in the urban lower class, lower middle income sections of society on this kind of state largesse. So he has to maintain that kind of clientelistic networks, and people are dependent on this. So people vote for Erdogan, in my opinion, not because they're in love with his populist, nationalist, or sometimes Islamist narrative, but they vote for bread and butter issues. They vote for basically a situation where they can have economic stability, some spending opportunities, and the hope of upward mobility. Now, is there a limit to what he can do? There is a clear limit in the absence of real structural institutional reforms. And Turkey has reached a plateau where it is showing all the symptoms of a middle-income trap country, where it's not able to invest really in good quality education. There is no innovation. There's not enough research and development. The state is too much involved in all these affairs. There is no rule of law, as we mentioned. So there are limits to how much Erdogan can continue on this winning formula. And the worse the economy will get, and we're approaching a moment of, in my opinion, sooner or later, reckoning in terms of whether he can continue to spend at this level without reaching higher inflation rates and jeopardizing the fiscal discipline, then he will double down on his nationalist and populist narrative. We're already seeing the symptoms of that. But I would caution for those who hope that an economic crisis would bring the end of Erdogan, because despite all the structural problems of the Turkish economy, on the main issue of public sector, public deficit to GDP, Turkey is still around 30%. The public deficit to GDP ratio is 30% below the Maastricht criteria. The Maastricht criteria is 60% for monetary union. Turkey has 30%. It has room to engage in fiscal stimulus, to engage in fiscal spending without jeopardizing the public sector borrowing that much. The problem is in the private sector. There's a private sector accumulation of debt, and especially short-term debt, and that's why the alarm bells are more on the private sector, but don't discount Erdogan's ability to continue these public spending projects and to use mechanisms like the credit guarantees to private sector as much as he can to push for basically the public sector to cover for some of the deficiencies of the private sector. And he has the luxury to do that because of the reforms implemented in 2001. The banking sector is still, despite the looming penalties that are coming because of the Zarrab case, I think has overall the strong fundamentals, the Turkish banking sector, to survive this penalties and to continue this system of basically clientelism and public spending.
Thanks, Ömer. I'll turn to Şebnem and check with you whether what Ömer has just said is really plausible in the coming two, three years. Ömer, on the one hand, said the moment of reckoning is coming, but on the other, he also pointed out that the banking sector and the fiscal discipline still allows him room to keep buying the loyalty of the... How do you reflect on that? And then I think we'll start, we'll turn to questions and answers once we've finished the round.
Okay, so, and I'm going to speak very slowly now, so
yes.
You can...
I give you an extra 2 minutes.
Okay, let me start by saying I'm an economist, and I think every occupation should know the strengths and weaknesses of what they can do and they cannot do. So as economists, we are very good at analyzing a situation, you know, providing numbers, providing solutions. We are really good at that. We are really bad at predicting things, forecasting things. Okay, so we cannot predict crisis. I mean, we solved this in the United States, in Europe, in many emerging markets. So, you know, I don't know really when that reckoning moment is going to come. And And I agree with Mr. Ömer that I don't think we should be in the business of predicting economic crisis, or we should hope that there's an economic crisis in Turkey and that will be the end of Erdogan. You know, we don't know these things. You know, it may be, it may not be. So, but it is not about that. It is really about, let's look at the current situation in detail and let's analyze, can we go on with this current situation? So let me pick at a couple things Mr. Ömer said. It is true that Turkish government has a lot of fiscal room. The public debt to GDP is, you know, a little bit higher than 30%, but definitely lower than 40%. Much lower than European Maastricht standard. Much lower than advanced countries like US, Italy, you know, Greece. That's true. But we also know that these numbers can go very quickly over 100 in moments of crisis. Once you're in a confidence crisis, you can go from 30-40% debt over 120 in days, as happened to Japan, as happened to Italy. Spreads are going to shoot up. You are going to be, you know, like desperately trying to find funds in the international markets. This brings me to this very important point that you cannot analyze Turkish economy independent from global economy. Turkey is a small, open economy. Okay, Turkey is not China. Turkey doesn't have those huge savings and reserves as China has. Turkey has an external deficit, meaning on the short-term basis, Turkey has to borrow every day from international financial markets to get the economy going. On the longer-term basis, it also has to borrow to get these technical imports to FDI and all the good things we talk about. But just as a fact of manner, Turkey is dependent on the global financial markets, has to borrow to just keep running the economy. Now, this means the developments in the international financial markets, global economy is very important for Turkey, both on the good side and the bad side. Let me say a little bit on the good side. Mr. Ömer is exactly right. There is a strong banking sector in the economy, and government has room with these low levels of fiscal discipline, low levels of debt. This is not something Erdogan achieved. Let me make this very clear. AKP government and Erdogan has nothing to do with this. This is 2002 reforms after the financial crisis, complete IMF program, very standard, applied many emerging countries with these type of crisis. The crisis of 2001-2002 was a triple crisis with banking sector, government sector, and the exchange rate crisis. It is a very typical solution to that crisis. I just told you, right? As economists, we are very good providing solutions after things happen. Very, very typical recipe to that crisis. Happened in South Korea, happened in Argentina, happened many countries before. Very typical growth after such a program. You rein the inflation, you bring fiscal discipline, which brings macroeconomic and financial stability. All AKP government did not mess up with this program. And political stability, fine, I agree with that. But on the economic ground, they just didn't mess up this program. They have nothing to do with this program. This is a very standard program, which brought low inflation, fiscal discipline, all that. Now, moving forward, of course, this gives you a strong financial sector, banking sector, a lot of fiscal room on the government side that many European countries lacked. That's why when the crisis came, many European countries fell like dominoes. Okay, all good so far. But the problem, again, comes back to the fact that Turkey is a small open economy and Turkey keeps borrowing. Why things kept so long going on is because that strong financial sector, that strong banking sector, kept borrowing overseas. Why? Because dollar is cheap. With this cheap dollar, with these things happened in US and Europe, if you look at the global financial markets, borrowing in dollar is extremely cheap. Turkish banking sector right now has around 50% external liabilities. That means banking sector is borrowing overseas. And they are fine. They are a strong banking sector. I fully agree. Strong banking sector means their liability side and asset side, you know, match. They borrow, they pay back. That's fine. What about the private sector? What about the private sector that is not in the tradable sector, meaning they don't have dollar incomes or euro incomes? Construction sector, right? These sectors borrow heavily in dollars. Okay. Right now, the Turkish private sector's dollar debt is around 50% of their total debt. And they don't have this type of income or revenue. What happens when Turkish lira depreciated more and when those borrowing costs on the banking sector or just anybody, a private company, tries to borrow overseas, those costs rise. When are those costs going to rise? When Federal Reserve start increasing the interest rates, when oil prices start increasing. Okay. These two things are extremely important for any small emerging market, and especially a market like Turkey that has still a current account deficit, still has to borrow up to 40% of GDP every day, right? Once you're, as a country, I mean, currently, yes, government is not borrowing, correct. Government is going to change. But the banking sector is borrowing, private sector is borrowing, and half of that borrowing is in dollars. When the cost of this borrowing start increasing, what is going to happen? Defaults are going to start rolling over. Right now, when you're in trouble, you keep rolling over. Banking sector keeps rolling this over because banking sector keeps financing this cheaply. There is going to be an end to this at some point. Who is going to enter at that point? The final stop. Who is the final stop? Who is the fiscal backstop? The government. I fully agree with Mr. Omer. They have the room. But that can maybe just last a week. Right? We saw these things. Look at the, yes, Italy government had big debt. Greece government had big debt. What about Portugal, Ireland, and Spain? You know, some of these governments didn't have this problem. But look at what happened there, spreads overnight. Spreads meaning the cost of funds for the government to borrow. They skyrocketed. What is Turkish government going to do in that sense? I mean, this links back. And they know this very well, too. The recent sovereign wealth fund initiative. That's exactly because of that. Because if your borrowing costs in the international market increase, even you still have the fiscal space, that stopped mattering because there's a confidence crisis about your country, then you borrow showing your sovereign wealth fund, right? The problem here is the only country that doesn't have a natural resource and that doesn't have savings like China, but has a sovereign wealth fund is Turkey. Because normally when countries have sovereign wealth funds, either they have a natural resource or they have savings, reserve accumulation, like China. So all these saying us that, again, going back to my key point that we can analyze the situation, these ingredients are not right. There is something wrong in this picture. You cannot go on this picture. But I cannot predict what will happen, when will it happen. And yes, maybe there won't be an economic crisis, right? But what we care is not really if there's an economic crisis, if this is the last, you know, the final days of, you know, this is not what is important. What is important is, as, you know, Turkish people and Turkish American, I'm a Turkish American, I want what is good for the country. What is good for the country is long-term sustainable growth, okay? That is not achievable with the current ingredients.
Thanks, Şebnem. If the Lord gives me a chance, I'll definitely study economy. Thanks, Şebnem. Yes, to go back to you, we're sort of changing subjects a bit here, but listening to Şebnem and listening to Ömer too, I can't help but see these huge black clouds accumulating in the horizon. And Turkey is a critical country for the European Union, not just for reasons to do with geostrategy, but also economics, and also something that the European Union fears a lot, migration. So how does the European Union handle Turkey with respect to this upgrading of the customs union when that quotation makes references to the implementation of the additional protocol, which to me means resolving the Cyprus problem? And it doesn't look like the Cyprus problem is about to resolve. And dare I say, you need to give some credit to the Erdogan governments that they made an effort to resolve it. Very briefly, because we're beginning to run out of time.
Sure. Thanks. Maybe if you allow me, because you questioned the situation of the German businesses, I've been in Turkey on that day when the list has been brought out, German businesses being accused to support terrorism. Mm-hmm. And the strong opinion we got from Berlin, and then taking off from the argument was actually just by hours, and I've been literally actually at the consulate in Istanbul on that day, showing how important it is to bring issues on the table, and that list has been done by Interpol, and showing already in which trap the Turkish government is, you know, playing two side situations, and also just want to underline, because we are taking that very much into account, that over 965 companies have been accused to support the Gulen movement. And we talk about over 10 billion being in the funds of the government. So who is running that? Who is controlling the companies?
That is a very, very important factor. And now being accused as a German company to kind of work because you have some trading relations with some of the companies, and being accused through that to be, take a part of the system of the Gulen movement. So they actually see the whole net where the Turkish government has to be so careful and not destroying its partners and its investors. And therefore, I can just underline what you have said, the importance of bringing the questions to the table and not playing two-sided. In terms of the Cyprus situation, things have changed a lot. I mean, we are so close to the Geneva talks on both sides, and we don't want to interlink the situation too much on the Cyprus question, you know, in terms of protocols. The protocol which has been taken, or actually the arrangements which have been taken by the member states in Turkey, looking at the migration situation, is not being supported by the European Parliament. We have not been asked. So there you see actually the European Union is, there are different columns on the democratic institutions. Nevertheless, we underlined in our report in July of this year that Turkey has taken one of the most important support of refugees, having over 3 million refugees in the country from the neighbor countries, but also to Afghanistan and others, that they play a major role in stabilizing the process, as the few refugees which came over to the giant Europe of 500 million people brought us already into a political crisis straightforward. And therefore, I think it's very important not to interlink our business situations with the refugee question, because Europe is big and strong. Even we have difficulties precisely on this political refugee question and the identity crises which emerge, and popularism and right-wing situations occurred to a strong extent. But we have to make clear that we are not getting and playing into this card, as has been many times said, even us being there in Turkey and being asked by the media there. So
it's very interesting. When I made references to migration, frankly, I didn't have the Syrian refugees in mind. I mean, public opinion surveys in Turkey for some time have been showing that the Syrian refugees do not aspire to move on. What I was more concerned of, if those dark clouds in the horizon, economic dark clouds in the horizon, really lead to a meltdown in the Turkish economy, what will happen to some of the individuals that will, they will feel that they need to move on to greener grasses? And the other day, a colleague of ours shared his public opinion survey results. Even though there is this much foul language narrative being used against the European Union in Turkey, when the Turkish public opinion is asked, if you intended to go abroad, where would you be going? None of them were saying Iran, Russia, or Saudi Arabia. It's the European Union.
Maybe just a sentence on that, because I'm very concerned on the brain drain coming from Turkey. It's not only helping other economies and scientific backgrounds. We have big scholarships in Germany for foreign academics, and it's actually tremendously how many most qualified people applying for their scholarships and actually achieving a lot of them right now. But from the long run, as you mentioned, the R&D factor, but also scientific fields, university education, we need these people in Turkey. And so I'm really calling as well on that topic. It has been heartbreaking seeing how many have been had to leave the country or being taken out of their work just because they signed to have peace in southeast of Turkey. So that is on the long run also a very important factor for the Turkish economy.
Thanks. We're going to go turn to the floor. So if there are any questions, as you come up to the microphones, this is the instruction I had. I will turn around and ask my final question to Ömer, and then ask him to weave it into your responses to the questions coming from the floor. Ömer, in the previous panel, towards the end, there was discussion of public opinion survey results. I understand from those survey results economic issues are beginning to make it back into the top of the list there. Terrorism is beginning to slip back down. We also hear a lot how AKP continues to be keen in running public opinion surveys and then trying to respond to them. As you respond to the questions from the floor, would you also please consider whether that that kind of input may be an input that that might encourage AKP and maybe its leader as well to move away from the kind of politics that in the economic realm is seems to be leading Turkey into a crisis? Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Your name and brief question, please.
My name is Mustafa Malik. Yes. I am not a Turk, even though my name is Mustafa. I was born in India. I have two questions. One is, Turkey's accession to the European Union, is it really an economic or human rights issue or an identity issue that you referred to? Even the refugee problem is an identity issue, and it is creating tremendous chaos in Europe. Turkey, if it were a member of the European Union, in the couple of years would be the largest EU country by population. It's already there. Do you think Western Europe will really want the largest European Union country, a Muslim country? Will a government in Berlin or Paris stay in power after admitting Turkey? I researched this issue in Western Europe and Turkey. I saw it has nothing to do with economic issue. When you talk about human rights, what's the human rights situation in Poland or Hungary? Mr. Orban is called a dictator. So suppose, do you think realistically Turkey becoming a EU member, even if it resolves the human rights situation? Second question. If that does not happen, what kind of relationship do you expect between Turkey or European Union, like customs union or whatever it is? Most Europeans and Turks have given up on, European
thanks.
Union. Thank you.
Very good question. Yes, sir.
Sinan Hastor, two questions. One is purely economic. The other one is non-economic. First, the Professor Kalemli, she mentioned there was real growth between 2002 and 2007 in Turkey. I wonder if that kind of growth was really based on the real economy or just the financial, just the improvement on the financial side. And one aspect of that that wasn't mentioned, that hasn't been mentioned so far, is privatization. As any economist can will tell you, privatization can be a positive thing when done in the right way, but can be a negative thing as well. So I wondered how much of a role did privatization play in providing those funds that were later spent, used for public spending. My second question is to Honorary Leeds. With regard to the European Union's approach to Turkey, Professor Krisci mentioned the carrots, providing carrots as well as sticks in the in motivating a country to change its behavior, democratize, etc. Do you think that ever since Turkey was declared a formal candidate country, did the EU really provide the requisite carrots as well as sticks to Turkey to move towards membership? And by that, in the run up to the latest German elections, for example, I remember a quote by Cem Özdemir, one of the co-chairs of the German Green Party, saying, "We discovered Turkey, or the government of Angela Merkel discovered Turkey all of a sudden when the migration crisis broke out. But before then, they weren't really very interested in Turkey as moving forward in this process. All of a sudden, Turkey became a very important country in the eyes of the German government."
Thank you. Yes, and then we'll turn the panel and conclude.
I have two questions. One
name,
is
please.
For, I'm sorry? Your name, please.
Oh, my name is Ilhan Kagri. I work for the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Thank you.
The first question is to Mr. Litz. You mentioned several times that the European Union was very concerned about human rights and interested in human rights, and yet I'm wondering how you respond to the accusation that some people make that in order for Turkey to keep it, the Syrian refugees, that Europe has decided to turn a blind eye towards Turkey's human rights abuses. And the second question is to Shabnam, and that is that what effect is the large Syrian sort of immigrant refugee population having on the Turkish economy? And I know you said economists aren't good at projections, but if you could give it a stab in terms of what the possible projections are in terms of the effect they'll have on the economy.
Thank you. Given that some of the questions were very European Union focused on, can we start with you and especially the gentleman with the name Mustafa? My old man was called Mustafa Kemal, so.
Sure.
What kind of a relationship in the future, especially, yes?
We're only allowed to speak for 1 minute in the European Parliament, so.
I'll give you 2-3 minutes.
Wow.
I'm more generous than the European Parliament.
That opens up also good relations. I will tackle them kind of together because some of them have been asked from a different layer and perspective. I give you one story when I have been meeting the Obman of Human Rights in Turkey. And he asked us, so, listen, we have been... We went there with the Committee of Human Rights. At that time, we still met the governmental officials. So he said, we tried so hard to become a member and to move speedy up in the process to become a member of the European Union, and we have not entered yet. So we have been standing at the doorstep, and you have not opened up too quick enough. So now we are going through the window. And I asked him then afterwards, do you see that as a window of opportunity in terms of good relationships to interact with each other? So by saying that we have had started this process, the European Union, and yes, politically, and that goes also to the question of the, the politician of the Green Party, we have different layers in the German political field, for example. Mrs. Merkel has not been a good friend of the idea and the conservatives of Germany to have Turkey as a member of the European Union, and she's still saying that straightforwardly. We as the Democrats question that, and yes, even you recall to a Muslim country, we have these difficulties even on refugees now in the European Union. For example, Orban saying we are not welcoming any refugees of a different religion. We have actually the freedom of religion in the European Union as a basic value. So the question is, do we stay or not stay on our values? And I think that should and must not be the crucial question of the religious part. If Turkey comes up and fulfilling the Copenhagen criteria, yes, because we are in the process, but we are not there yet. And so it's not the situation to enter now through the window, because it needs to be the door and the doorstep which needs to be passed. So that is a very important situation. And in terms of taking a blind eye, not blind eye, I underlined, and I make this again, that the European Parliament on the refugee question has a different say with the Commission together than the member states do. The member states don't want to share and take up and build up a new Dublin system and actually have not even agreed fully, and now we had these lawsuits also from Hungary and the Visegrad countries, not taking refugees into their countries, as we have to being on solidarity on that track. So we are in this political situation, which is difficult, but in terms of human rights, I call as a member to fulfill the human rights also for the refugees in Turkey, and if this is not the case, then they have to go somewhere else. Being able to enter the European Union as they are refugees of war. This is done by the Geneva treaties. But we have difficulties now, as you all know, that to fulfilling the standards across the European Union. And therefore, these are the European struggles we are having ourselves right now. I think 3 minutes are over.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Ömer, can you, the public opinion, and then also maybe the EU, the future of EU-Turkish relations, how do you see
it? I know the director of the Turkey program at the Middle East Institute, Gönül Tol, tried hard to get an AKP person here, and we don't have an AKP voice. So let me try to answer the question that you asked with an eye on how an AKP person would answer that question about opinion polls. If AKP is often blamed, or Erdogan is often blamed for dictatorial tendencies or for becoming a dictator, someone representing the AKP would say, dictators are not in the opinion polls business. They don't look at opinion polls. They also don't care much about the economic performance because they know they will win. They don't win elections by a very small margin. They usually win with sham elections with 80%, 90%. What I'm trying to say is that if we want to be charitable to the AKP, we have to understand that despite all the authoritarian tendencies in the country, Turkish democracy still has a pulse. And it's basically about elections. What we have left in Turkey mm-hmm. are elections. And it is absolutely critical for the West to send election monitors to Turkey next time so that elections are not rigged. The fact that Erdogan won with a very slim margin, despite this draconian law, created alarm bells after the referendum. The fact that he couldn't win with 55%, 56%, despite having all this propaganda machine behind him, shows that he's worried about public opinion. He's worried about the youth. He's worried about the urban areas. That's why I think he decided to change the mayors of all these big cities in Turkey. And he has an eye on the economic situation. He needs to deliver. He cannot afford to burn the bridges with the European Union. Sooner or later, once he has more political capital to spend, once he's more secure in his seat. Again, I'm trying hard to be charitable to this vision. He may do a U-turn on a number of issues. He may do a U-turn on the EU. He may do a U-turn on even the Kurdish question, maybe. It's hard to see it now, but he's a Machiavellian politician. He's very pragmatic. I don't think he's an Islamist in a pure sense. He's more of a pragmatic populist and a nationalist than an ideologue. Today, conservative nationalism is playing well. He's playing that drum. But the reason why he's so much into opinion polls is because he's a populist and he has to win elections. And I hope we will keep it that way, because if we lose the electoral ballot box in Turkey, we have nothing left. Mm.
Thank you, Ömer. You were very charitable. I hope it works out along the lines you suggested. Şebnem, there were a number of questions on the economic side, the privatization and the cost of the Syrian refugees on the economy, and then we'll close.
Okay, so in terms of the question if this growth was real or financial, it was a real growth. I mean, so at the end of the day, of course, they go together because you measure in monetary terms the value of output. But basically how we measure GDP growth is you look at how much the value of output grow from X point to Y point, and then we try to understand the components of that. So as of 2002, with all the reforms and the economic program and all that, you know, when we look at that growth rate, like how much, you know, gross domestic product, GDP grow, and how much of it is this, and this, you know, it looked very real, in especially this sense. That growth is going to have three parts, right? One is just pure population growth, because population is also, you know, growing, if you wish, that's the most real part. The second one is the factor accumulation, the factor growth, meaning the capital, right? Capital, human capital, so that's like how much, you know, skilled workforce grow, how much, you know, the actual capital grow, so that can be taught something financial. And then the third part is this part that generally we call a residual, because we really cannot measure that well, but that's the kind of remainder, right? Once you take out population growth from that gross domestic product growth, and then how much the financial side capital investment grow, then the remaining is what we call kind of real productivity growth. So it's a measure of how much we became better at doing things, how more efficient we are. And that part is general tied to research and development, innovation, technology, and all that. So that part also grew, right? And because that part we know that part needs structural reforms, for sure. You cannot, be better at things, you cannot innovate, you cannot be better at R&D and all that without structural reform. So in that sense, it was real. Now, linking it to privatization is very hard because privatization is going to be part of that investment growth, right? That, how much capital grow. And, of course, that's in its essence something financial. But I'm sure there are studies that look at those numbers because, as you said, privatization can be good or bad depending on how the funds use. But, again, the important part is this other part, how, better we are at doing things, producing things. So in that sense, it was real. And the refugee question... This can also be something like privatization. It can go good or bad, right, in the sense that you have 3 million people added to your workforce, right? Mm-hmm. In a growing economy, this is actually a very good thing. If you're growing, if you have an economy growing over 7-8%, this is exactly part of how China, integrated the whole world economy. You have all these people now willing to work. You can incorporate them to your growing economy. That's a good thing. But if your economy is not growing at that fast rate that can find jobs and incorporate these people to the economy, then that can be a drag. I personally didn't do any projections on this myself, but there are like several studies doing this, and my sense from these studies is in the medium to long run being like 5 years and beyond, that's going to be a drag on the economy if the growth rate of the economy doesn't pick up. If it does, then of course it can be a good thing, but current situation is going to be a negative on the economy.
One tiny detail to add on Syrian refugees and the point that Shebnem just made on population growth is that part of that population is actually engaged in the Turkish economy, formally, but mostly informally. And what's happening every year is that when you divide the GDP into the population, that population is not included in the calculation. So their contribution to that economy gets divided up by only Turkish nationals and helps the per capita income to look better. So that's one of the advantages that Syrian refugees bring to the Turkish table there that gets overlooked sometimes. Arne, I know you wanted to make a remark, I think, as we close the panel.
Thank you so much. In terms of the informally, they're 30%, if I'm not mistaken, the informal sector. So that is actually a giant sector if you look at the business economy in the country. I just wanted to underline what you said is, looking at the next polls, as we still have these instruments, we still have also Cumhuriyet running like as one of the news agencies. So we have to stick what we have, and we have to underline that wherever we go in Turkey and talking in public there as well, we always underline that we're standing on behalf of the citizen who are strongly believing in the rule of law, in justice, who are calling for free media and democracy, and that's what we are underlying as members of the European Parliament. This has been done because I come from East Germany with Americans and other ones who are supporting us and telling they are supporting these people in the countries. I come from an opposition family, so I know exactly why this is important to underline, and I was very thankful that you make this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Arne. I'd like to thank Ömer, Arne, and Shebnem for a great panel here, and Gönül, I can't see you there, but over there, I managed to finish this panel in time in return for that little publicity you made about my book. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking our panelists and wonderful moderator, and we'll break for